Good morning, everyone. My name is Michael Duchenne, Director of Programming at Perimeter Institute. Welcome to this morning's lecture, Why Are You People Not Running in the Oktoberfest Run? Anybody who had trouble turning past the runners, our apologies for that. Hope you managed to get here without too much trouble. This morning, we are pleased again to welcome Robert Schulman, who was with us yesterday. Robert Schulman received his PhD from the University of Chicago, studying modern German social and intellectual history and medieval history. He went on to postdoctoral studies at the Institute for European History in Mainz, Germany. From 1984 to 2000, he was a professor of German history at Boston University. As well, from 1981 to 84, he began as associate editor of the Albert Einstein Project for the publication of all of Einstein's correspondence and writings at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, New Jersey. He assumed the role of editor-in-chief and director of the Albert Einstein Project from 1987 to 2000 and continued as contributing editor from 2000 to 2004. When the project moved to California Institute of Technology. At Caltech, he was also a visiting research associate in the Division of Humanities and Social Sciences. During his time at the Albert Einstein Project, he edited 9 volumes of the collected papers of Albert Einstein covering the years 1879 to 1921 for Princeton University Press. In addition, he has lectured and written numerous articles and book chapters dealing with the life of Einstein, particularly in its social context. Most recently, he has co-edited a source book with David Rowe entitled The Political Einstein, Private Thoughts and Public Passions, scheduled for publication by Princeton University Press in 2006. And he is presently working on a biography of Einstein's life up to 1925. Please welcome Robert Schulman.
Thank you, Michael, and thanks to the Perimeter Institute for inviting me for this marathon of our own here at the Perimeter Institute. I think it's probably important that in this year of the 100-year celebration of Einstein's great works that we look behind the icon and see something, put some flesh on the bones of the old man, and that's what I'm going to try and do today. Universally recognized as a physicist of the first rank, Albert Einstein as a political figure is far more difficult to assess. He never engaged systematically in the activities of any political party, and throughout his life maintained some distance from the political fray. Unlike professional politicians, he was not accountable to any constituency other than himself. Drawing on his international fame as the second Newton, he enjoyed the luxury of reflecting on politics and directing his energy to social ends without making the usual political compromises. Events were to alter his views, but never to force concessions of principle. Einstein's political interests only crystallized in 1919 after his most startling discoveries in physics lay behind him. In the critical years leading up to his greatest scientific achievements, his political and social interests lay fallow, their moral roots unarticulated. After an initial period of fiercely independent religious piety, which lasted until the age of 12, attributable in part to youthful rebellion against his parents' rejection of religious Judaism, Einstein was drawn by his readings in the natural sciences in his early teens into the web of natural phenomena and a lifelong attempt to comprehend them. A self-conscious distancing from emotional involvement followed, as well as contempt for everyday concerns and a reveling in his outsider status. Merely personal contacts were relegated to the margins. In the process of single-mindedly defining his path, Einstein fashioned for himself a set of friendships, affiliations, and commitments which were at some remove from the world at large. He created for himself a solitary world, choosing a circle of friends and finding mentors that shared his distaste for convention and pursued similar unorthodox career paths. Here's a picture of him from about 1902, when he is already, just before he begins his work at the Patent Office, and he has created a little bohemian club with others to discuss philosophy and science. And he gave it the sort of self-mocking title, the Olympia Academy. The lack of a well-established academic physics discipline at the end of the 19th century also served to reinforce Einstein's sense of isolation. This, coupled with the young man's strong antipathy toward authority and ruthless definition of priorities, led to an indifference to engaging the external world, an indifference that persisted throughout his early academic career. Thrust into the limelight after the solar eclipse expeditions of 1919, about which some of you may have heard yesterday, Einstein made his first overt political statement at the end of that year, after the announcement of verification of his theory of general relativity by the British Royal Society. This dramatic announcement by Britain's most prestigious academic body conferred upon him an unparalleled international legitimacy, reinforced by a public fascination with the idea of finding certainty in the stars, which had proved elusive in the turmoil of the war that had just ended, First World War. Thus was born the Einstein myth of the all-knowing sage, equally conversant with the laws of physics as with those of human affairs. Thus were also born the unrealistic expectations of those that sought from him oracular truths, as well as the unreasonable charges of naivete, which surround the legend of the political Einstein to this day. Most importantly, this watershed marked the emergence of an Einstein who committed himself actively to the pursuit and implementation of his social ideals. My contention in today's talk is that it was the recovery of Judaism that opened to him his path to political engagement. After decades of lone searching for physical truths, Einstein yearned for a sense of authentic community and found one, first in the young underprivileged students of Berlin, and then in the larger sense of connectedness with what he called his Stammesgenossen. The best way to translate, some people have translated that as tribal companions, but that really has an atavistic ring to it. I would call them kith and kin, borrowing perhaps from the Anglo-Saxon. His initial empathy was triggered by identification with poor Jewish students of Eastern Europe, whose situation bore striking similarities to his own financial plight as a student, and with the marginal existence of his small band of comrades in arms in Switzerland. In contrast to the East European Jews, however, he had been spared the virulent anti-Semitism which was rearing its head in post-war Germany. After all, Einstein had been in Switzerland until 1914, that is, until he was 35 years old. He had left Munich as a young boy, as a 15-year-old. Today I will do two things. First, briefly recapitulate those elements from his early years which illustrate a latent Jewish sensibility. Second, examine in some detail the trajectory of his Jewish concerns from 1919 to the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. As he was later to recount in his autobiographical notes, until the age of 12, Einstein observed Jewish religious tradition with almost fanatical zeal. In a rather sudden change of heart, perhaps brought on in part by anticipation of his bar mitzvah the following year, he turned his interests at the age of 13 in 1892 to philosophical and scientific pursuits. For the next 2.5 decades, Einstein's early fascination with Judaism would lie submerged, a period that I refer to as his moratorium as a Jew. It persisted uneventfully from his declaration of dissidence, a term which means at that time non-membership in a religious community. His declaration of dissidence in 1896 on a document renouncing his German citizenship, to his appointment as a full professor in Prague 15 years later in 1911. Those intervening years saw Einstein move from southern Germany to Italy and finally to Switzerland in 1895 at the age of 16. There he completed his secondary school education, received his teacher's diploma, landed a well-paying job at the Swiss Patent Office, wrote the great papers, the centenary of which we celebrate this year, got his first academic appointment at the University of Zurich in 1909, and moved on to the Charles University in Prague after only three semesters. The move from democratic Zurich to imperial Prague, which was at that time part of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, was painful. Einstein felt most comfortable in Switzerland, but advancing his career came first. Suggestions by some scholars that Einstein developed an interest in Zionism while in Prague are based on wishful thinking, and on the fact that some of his acquaintances there were involved in that movement. One of them later categorically denied that Einstein had shown any interest, and he himself, as late as 1917, expressed some contempt for what he called the Zionist contaminated circle of outsiders with a medieval cast of mind that were loosely grouped around philosophers at the university in Prague. The choice of terms is interesting. Outsider, his term, could fairly be applied to Einstein himself, but at this point, Zionism was not the focus of his own marginal interests. Concentrated research work into the quantum and the beginnings of his general theory of relativity held pride of place. There is no question that he felt uncomfortable with the stuffy imperial traditions in Bohemia, both academic and otherwise. But a pragmatic approach prevailed. Confronted by the Habsburg Emperor's insistence that no atheist could hold a civil service post, professors at universities are civil servants, Einstein, this may be true in Canada too, I don't know, not in the States, Einstein, who had consistently denied his membership in an organized religion for 15 years, now blithely declared his willingness to be considered a Jew, remarking in the following terms, "Returning to the bosom of Abraham meant nothing to me. It merely involved a piece of paper that had to be signed." Clearly, at this point, he is not a convinced Jew. In spite of this cavalier dismissal of religion, there was at least one hint that Jewish concerns were not far from the surface. Informed mistakenly that he would not receive a call to Prague in 1910, he attributed it to, quote, "my Semitic ancestry." All evidence, however, points to continued indifference. His refusal of an invitation to visit anti-Semitic Russia in 1914, which had just had pogroms for probably the last 30 years, may not unfairly be attributed to his reluctance to abandon, even for a short period, his search for the field equations of general relativity. As I tried to show in yesterday's talk, Einstein's political initiation was facilitated by a number of factors. Most obviously, the authority conferred on him by the verification of his theory of general relativity and his canonization by the British Royal Society in late 1919. Important in this respect also was an attempt to escape private travails, including a protracted and unpleasant battle to divorce Mileva, whom he married in 1903, to postpone, and from whom he was separated in 1914, to postpone marriage with his cousin Elsa, and to maintain visiting rights with his sons. He had two sons by Mileva. Another important factor was the sense of alienation that the southerner initially felt in the North German capital, a feeling that he pithily characterized as his fear of Verberlinerung, to be Berlinized, to be made into a Berliner. But it is above all the sense of solidarity he felt for the disadvantaged East European Jews, especially the students in their number, that made him receptive to a recovery of Judaism. New ideologies and the parties that espoused them vied with one another for influence in Weimar Germany. All were beneficiaries of new won freedoms, but extremists on the left and right frequently availed themselves of violent means to enlist support and gain their ends. Venomous anti-Semitism, projected by many right-wing nationalists and the radical right, became increasingly prevalent. Though Einstein's personal encounters with this poison were relatively few, he witnessed public humiliation of friends and especially of the large East European Jewish community in Berlin. Approximately 25% of the Jewish population of Berlin were East European Jews. Many of them had come voluntarily to a welcoming labor market in Germany, especially in the mines of Western Germany. And others were dragooned by German troops during the war to serve as wartime laborers. But I think you have to recall that at this period of time, the Germans were welcomed as liberators of the East European Jews, because after all, the East European Jews had been living under the yoke of Russian anti-Semitism, which had really begun the severe pogroms in the beginning of the 1880s. So the Germans were, ironically viewed from today's point of view, were viewed as liberators and welcomed the idea of immigrating to Germany. The blind racial hatred directed toward these Jews shocked him. I saw worthy Jews basely caricatured, and the sight made my heart bleed, he says. I saw how schools, the satirical press, and countless other cultural institutions of the Gentile majority undermined the confidence of even the best of my fellow Jews, and felt that this could not be allowed to continue. This resolve, which stemmed from something he called purely instinctive, was the spur to recovering what he called my Jewish soul. While Einstein's transformation did not occur overnight, it was an epiphany of sorts. By abandoning the assimilating, what he called the mimicry of the butterfly, the Jew could begin to develop pride in himself and in the community of which he was a part. Arriving at a considered opinion on an array of public questions was not a simple matter, however. The first challenge for his developing political sensibility was to reconcile his genuine affection for German culture with his abhorrence of its prevailing militarism. Another was to find a balance between empathy for specific constituencies, such as his fellow scientists in Central Europe and or his Jewish brethren, and his commitment to internationalism, firmly rooted in his belief in the transnational character of science. It is the dynamic contradiction between national allegiance and international sympathies that defined Einstein's search for a Jewish identity and his growing commitment to Zionism. Decisive for him was the insight that, as with the assimilated Jew who lost his way by denying solidarity with his brethren, he himself, in his self-absorbed world, had lost a sense of kinship with the larger world, especially with his fellow Jews. Einstein had viewed the jingoism of wartime Germany as a moral affront. After the war, this amorphous sensibility took on a specifically political character as Einstein confronted the growing hostility toward Jews in German society. The argument of when anti-Semitism begins to flower, if you want to use that term, in Germany is, of course, something that is open to debate, although I would argue that the end of the First World War is really the point of takeoff for that virus in German society, although, of course, it existed before that. Anti-Semitism harbored another, even uglier lie, one that particularly outraged Einstein. Gentile contempt for the Jew was one thing, but even more despicable, he found, the scorn which his fellow German Jews heaped on their Russian and Polish brethren, the so-called Ostjuden. These socially and economically disadvantaged members of the Jewish community, numbering about 30,000 in Berlin, represented somewhat more than one quarter of the total Jewish population of Berlin. Various measures contemplated by the Prussian government to control and even deport East European Jews after the war exacerbated the fear of many German Jews that they were the real targets of official displeasure. So that while there was a policy of welcoming East European Jews at a time when there were great labor needs in Germany during the war, the Prussian government, of which Berlin is a part, had decided by the end of the war, and especially afterward with returning soldiers and high unemployment, that East European Jews were who of course were not German citizens, were a commodity that needed to be shunted aside. Einstein dismissed this fear with the fear of German Jews toward their East European brethren with the acerbic observation that it was, quotes, a Jewish weakness always and anxiously to try to keep the Gentiles in good humor. Jewish antisemitism, he thought, represented nothing less than a degrading ritual of redirecting onto the most vulnerable members of the community the Gentile antisemitism intended for all Jews. In assimilating to the demands of the larger society and internalizing its expectations, Jews were abasing themselves. Quotes, let us leave antisemitism to the Aryan and save love for our own kind. Given the depth of his feeling on this matter, it comes as little surprise that Einstein's first public stance on a political matter was a protest of the official and unofficial discrimination practiced against East European Jews, which appeared as an article in a liberal Berlin daily at the end of 1919. Acutely, Einstein had come to realize, quotes, that the excessive price at which the blessings of assimilation are bought by Jewish communities, a loss of solidarity, of moral independence, and of self-respect. Seem to have lost my... On another occasion, he pointed out that it cannot be the task of the Jews to obtain immunity from the anti-Semites by accusing any part of their own people. This attitude reveals a severe misconception of both the law and of the significance of anti-Semitism, whose presumption of sitting in judgment on the Jewish people we will never accept. The solution, he thought, was straightforward. More dignity and self-reliance in our own ranks. Only then, when we dare view ourselves as a nation, nation, of course, at this time now has, the German word is Volk, which, as you know, is a very complicated word, which can be attributed to a Volkswagen, to a car. It also has lots of tribal connotations. It is one of these mystic terms that the nation has lost completely in the present day. So the word, when he speaks of nation here, he speaks of a community bound together by tradition and by blood. Only then, when we respect ourselves, will we gain the respect of others. Alternatively, they will come to us on their own. By expressing solidarity with an East European Jewish community that had maintained authenticity through loyalty to its roots, their assimilated German brethren, too, might recapture a sense of communal worth. Einstein's conclusion, Zionism is the only effort which leads us closer to the goal of healing divisiveness and uniting all Jews. Though he was aware of the contradiction with his internationalist sympathies, Einstein argued that an embrace of Zionist nationalism was a necessary step in the elevation of Jewish self-esteem. He couched this explanation for resolving the contradiction in the form of a parable. I am against nationalism, but I am in favor of the Zionist cause. The reason for this has become apparent to me. If a man has both arms and incessantly boasts of the strength of his right arm, then he is a chauvinist. If a man be missing his right arm, however, he must do all in his power to compensate for the missing limb. For this reason, I am, in my personal attitude, an opponent of nationalism. As a Jew, however, I support the Jewish national efforts of the Zionists. The fatal illusions of assimilation could best be avoided by undertaking tasks in common. Of these, the most important was the restoration of Jewish national life in Palestine, the very heart of the Zionist enterprise. Two visions of this enterprise dominated. One stressed the spiritual and cultural character of Zionism, the other its political goals. Cultural Zionists directed their energies toward a Palestine which would rekindle the spiritual life of the diaspora, and in which Palestine and diaspora would stand in constant reciprocal spiritual relationship. This group, the cultural Zionists, sought relatively modest funding for individual enterprise committed to the social and economic development of Palestine as a cultural homeland of world Jewry. The political Zionists, on the other hand, believed that the political struggle had only just begun and stressed the importance of mass colonization and ambitious supporting budgets to advance the cause of a Jewish state there. Einstein's adherence was clear from the beginning. His advocacy of Zionism, of Zionism's cultural aspect always outweighed purely political considerations. Shortly after his first and only visit to Palestine in 1923, he wrote to a friend, "On the whole," that's Einstein and his wife in the middle, "on the whole, the country, Palestine, is not very fertile. It will become a moral center, but will not be able to absorb a large proportion of the Jewish people." In her unpublished biography, Einstein's sister states unequivocally that his impulse to support Zionism sprang out of a, quote, "sense of responsibility for providing an independent domain for those kinfolk who, as Jews, were denied a place where their intellectual prowess in the sciences might be given creative play." Creating such an institution of higher learning, the Hebrew University, was the centerpiece of a cultural Zionist vision that would instill pride and provide a livelihood for countless young students and their teachers. Einstein argued that its establishment was not a question of taste, but of necessity. As a first step to the realization of this dream, he began in Berlin in the spring of 1920 to offer accredited university courses to Jewish students unable because of the quota system to register at the University of Berlin. Prospects for a university in Palestine initially looked poor. The European leadership of the World Zionist Organization in London was strapped for funds and embroiled in political bickering with its largest affiliate, the Zionist Organization of America. The Europeans favored the formation of a political entity in Palestine, while the American Zionists supported a cultural settlement. In spite of Einstein's natural inclination to the, quote, "American position," when the London organization requested that he join its delegation on a fundraising mission to the United States in 1921, he agreed, quotes, "without giving it more than 5 minutes of thought." Much as he had made a principled compromise in accepting Zionist nationalism in the face of a bedrock faith in internationalism, so Einstein, ever the pragmatist, accepted in the name of solidarity the political agenda of the International Zionist Organization, though his sympathies lay elsewhere. The trip to America, while modest in its fundraising success, took on the character of a triumphal procession for Einstein, who was singled out for adulation by large crowds of recent East European Jewish immigrants to the United States. As you know, possibly until 1923-24, when the Americans also shut the doors to immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, the largest proportion of East European Jews, Russians, some of them, of course, also to Canada, but overwhelmingly went to North America. This ended then in 24 when the Americans reacted to what they considered to be the unfavorable wave of immigration. They are now going through the throes of that again. Not all were pleased with his decision. Visits by prominent individuals from former enemy nations so soon after the war were frowned upon. You have to realize that Einstein, for instance, couldn't make a trip to France the mortal enemy of Germany in the First World War, couldn't make a trip to France until 1922, 4 years after the war. And this for someone who, of course, had been completely neutral and internationalist in his sympathies. So it was extremely difficult for members of former belligerents to visit one another. When his friend and colleague, the physical chemist Fritz Haber, scolded him for his disloyalty to the German state by making such a trip, Einstein explained where his loyalties lay. He reiterated his conviction 5 years later. He who remains true to his origin, race, and tradition will also remain loyal to the state of which he is a subject. He who is faithless to the one will also be faithless to the other. I've called this the fraternal opposites, which is something that has been ascribed to the relationship of Einstein and Fritz Haber by Fritz Stern, the German historian at Columbia University. Fraternal opposites. Einstein was the archetype of the non-assimilated Jew. Fritz Haber was the archetype of the assimilated Jew. He had developed, among other things, in addition to ammonia, which furthered the war effort in Germany, had also developed poison gas, and was a more German than the Germans, shall we say. Einstein, on the other hand, as you have heard, was someone who viewed this from the outside. On the other hand, they were extremely close personal friends. He reiterated his conviction 5 years later. I've already said that. The Balfour Declaration of 1917 had recognized the Zionist aim of a national home for the Jewish people. Here's the Balfour of the Balfour Declaration. In setting up a British mandatory authority there 3 years later, the League of Nations used the same expression, national home. Much in the development of Zionism over the next 30 years would hinge on the interpretation of this phrase. For those like Einstein who emphasized the cultural aspects of Zionism, a national home in Palestine implied colonization in the pursuit of a cultural center that might be shared politically with other groups, all under the aegis of the British mandate. Back in Germany from his American trip, Einstein summed up his position. The goal which draws on the leaders of Zionism is not a political one, but a social and cultural. The community in Palestine should approach the social ideal of our forefathers, much as it was laid down in the Bible, while at the same time becoming a place of modern intellectual life, an intellectual center for Jews of the whole world. For those, on the other hand, who stressed the political aspects of Zionism, the goal was achieving the political independence of the Jewish people in the land of Palestine. A litmus test of attitudes was apparent in the relative importance assigned by each to the need for an understanding with the Arabs. For Einstein, it was paramount. For the political Zionists, it was, if not unattainable, secondary to encouraging maximum immigration to Palestine. Complementing the vision of a cultural center in Palestine was the ideal of creating farmers and laborers out of the largely urban Jewish population of Central Europe. Devotion to the land would be the new defining characteristic of the Jew in Palestine. To assist in this Herculean task of transformation, Einstein stressed the importance not of book learning, something that he didn't like anyway, but of a practical education that would provide the training needed to solve pressing problems in the area of agriculture and public health. In the mid-20s, following his only visit to Palestine in 1923, an almost imperceptible messianic tone crept into his language. Rather than attempting, as earlier, to reconcile internationalism with sympathy for the national aspirations of Jewry, his point of departure was that the moral renewal of Palestine would redound to the good of all mankind. Zionism, he wrote, is in the process of creating in Palestine a center of Jewish intellectual life, and thus we will always have to be thankful to its leaders. The existence of this moral homeland will, I hope, succeed in imparting more vitality to a people that does not deserve to die. I have been able to observe the first manifestations of this spiritual resurgence. For this reason, I believe that I am able to assert that Zionism, which appears to be a nationalistic movement, has, when it comes down to it, a significant role to play for all mankind. Here, just to clarify one thing, Einstein never embraced Judaism in the religious sense of the word. Here you see him with his secretary, Helen Dukas, attending a benefit concert at the Oranienburger Synagogue in Berlin to raise money for the Hebrew University. But Einstein was and remained a dissident with respect to the religious aspects of Judaism until his dying day. What defines his Judaism is his attachment to the cultural ideal and not to the religious. The shocking attacks by Arabs on Jewish settlements in spring 1929 did not shake his faith in the need for a modus vivendi with the Arab population, but he seems to have greatly misjudged the depth of Arab alienation. Quotes, "At no time did I get the impression that the Arab people might threaten the development of the Palestine project. I believe rather that among the working classes especially, Jew and Arab on the whole get on excellently together. The difficulties which are, as it were, inherent in the situation do not rise above the threshold of consciousness when one is on the spot. The problem of the rehabilitation and sanitation of the country seems incomparably more difficult." "We Jews must show," this is a continuation of that quote, "we Jews must show above all that our own history of suffering has given us sufficient understanding and psychological insight to know how to cope with this problem of psychology. The more so as no irreconcilable differences stand in the way of peace between Jews and Arabs in Palestine. Let us therefore above all be on our guard against blind chauvinism of any kind, and let us not imagine that reason and common sense can be replaced by British bayonets." His distance from the fray, and remember he never returned to Palestine, and his instinctive distrust of politicians led him to underestimate the power calculus that prevailed in Palestine by the end of the 1920s, as well as the growing intransigence in the positions of Jews, Arabs, and the British Mandatory Authority. But a new, more ominous factor was looming on the horizon, soon to cast its shadow over Europe and beyond. In 1930, Hitler and his National Socialists began what became a rapid accumulation of parliamentary power, culminating in their legal seizure of the reins of government on the 30th of January, 1933. Hitler was spending the winter at Caltech in Pasadena when he learned that Hitler had been appointed Chancellor of Germany. Less than a month later, the Reichstag was in flames, the parliament. Recognizing that the struggling German Republic had received a mortal blow, he now prepared for the long fight to save Germany from fascism. His first actions in support of this cause were to sever ties with Germany by revoking his citizenship and issuing two political statements characterizing his views on political freedom as well as on the acts of brutality perpetrated by the Nazi government against its Jewish citizens. Almost immediately on the seizure of power in 1933, Jews were suspended from the civil service and from the so-called free the professions, lawyers, and so. And many of Einstein's Jewish colleagues at that point were lost their jobs, including Haber, his fraternal opposite, who had to leave Germany and died on the way to Palestine, a kind of ironic reversal of Einstein's fate, and tragic also because he died then on the way to Palestine. Oppression of his fellow Jews caused Einstein to identify not only with their plight, but to take pride in their accomplishments. His tributes to the achievements of Jews in the foreword to The World as I See It, the first collection of his non-scientific writings, and in a lengthy article for an American magazine, provide mournful testimony to his solidarity with their fate. In protesting against Nazi persecution of non-Jews on political grounds, he recognized as well the salami tactics of the new rulers in Germany, in which the opposition would be lopped off slice by slice, beginning with the communists. Remember that the first real pogrom against Jews in Germany didn't, systematic pogrom against Jews in Germany didn't come until 1938, by which time Hitler had already decimated the ranks of the labor unions, the army, the church, and of course, initially the left wing, the communists and the social democrats. The resulting flood of refugees lucky enough to escape became a pressing concern for Einstein, who saw in them the bearers of Germany's most precious cultural values. Many of Einstein's political pronouncements during the 1930s dealt with cultural Zionism and the problems facing Jewish settlers in Palestine. He saw the labor movement as the key to peaceful relations in the Middle East. Quotes, "I consider the formation of labor unions necessary for Palestine, for the working class is not only the very soul of construction work, it is the only truly effective bridge between Jews and Arabs. Bureaucracies come and go, but human ties are decisive in the life of nations." At the same time, he also warned of the, quotes, "narrow nationalism within our own ranks, blasting right-wing Zionism for engaging in land speculation and denying Arab rights in Palestine." Social justice, as Einstein saw it, was the defining characteristic of Judaism, and he drew from this often uncomfortable political consequences. In 1938, he minced no words in voicing his opposition to the creation of a Jewish state. Quote, "I should much rather see reasonable agreement with the Arabs on the basis of living together in peace than the creation of a Jewish state. Apart from practical consideration, my awareness of the essential nature of Judaism resists the idea of a Jewish state with borders, an army, and a measure of temporal power, no matter how modest. I am afraid of the inner damage Judaism will sustain, especially from the development of a narrow nationalism within our own ranks, against which we have already had to fight strongly, even without a Jewish state. We are no longer the Jews of the Maccabee period. A return to a nation in the political sense of the word would be equivalent to turning away from the spiritualization of our community, which we owe to the genius of our prophets. If external necessity should, after all, compel us to assume this burden, that is of a state, let us bear it with tact and patience." He always left himself a back door. Einstein's position was set against the backdrop of hardening feeling among the Arabs, increasing favoritism on the part of the mandatory power Great Britain toward the Arabs, and practical Zionist aims concentrated on a nation state or nothing. In this context, Einstein's emphasis on the moral foundations of Zionism, as well as his internationalist and pacifist views, were increasingly at odds with the mainstream of the Zionist movement. After the Nazi seizure of power, Einstein had celebrated the Jewish cultural tradition and the fact that it had held its own in an increasingly hostile host society. As German policy turned from persecution to slaughter, Einstein's despair turned into a fierce resolve. As he saw it, the madness that gripped his native country not only uprooted vast numbers of human beings, but sought the extermination of what he called the fundamental structure of modern civilization. The magnitude of the refugee problem and uncharitable restrictions on admission in Western countries, including the United States, greatly increased the importance of Palestine as a potential place of refuge. Yet under the terms of a British white paper of 1939, Jewish immigration to Palestine, except for the filling of a minor quota allowance, was prohibited beginning April 1944. Hence the story of the Exodus ship and other things that have been popularized. Einstein's fury knew no bounds. If the Nazis were the chief villain of the peace, the British were their willing or unwitting henchmen by shutting off the last escape route for a people facing extinction. In testimony before the Anglo-American Committee in 1946, which made inquiry into the status of Palestine, He made no bones about his contempt for British policy. At the same time, he caused consternation among many Zionists by reiterating his resistance to the idea of a Jewish state and calling for a binational solution for the Palestine problem. Einstein's moderate position on the nature of the Jewish homeland was, however, being overtaken by events. In the middle of World War II, the chairman of the Jewish Agency's Palestine executive and later first prime minister of the State of Israel, David Ben-Gurion, called unequivocally for a Jewish army and the transformation of post-war Palestine into an independent Jewish commonwealth. Though non-Zionist organizations for the first time joined with their Zionist counterparts in advocating the establishment of such a state, Einstein resisted the calls for such a political solution. As the full horror of the systematic genocide of European Jews was revealed, however, the dynamic in favor of a Jewish state became irresistible. 2 years later, the State of Israel was proclaimed, 1948. Ever the cautious optimist, Einstein welcomed it, but with a reservation that is often overlooked today, overlooked in today's heated discussions of the Middle East. He argued that the new state's supreme moral test was yet to be met. The rescue quotes of our endangered brethren dispersed in many lands must not be won at the price of abandoning the ethical ideal of, quotes, peace based on understanding and self-restraint and not on violence. 10 years earlier, 1938, in an article entitled, Why Do They Hate the Jews?, written for the American family magazine Collier's, shortly after the first systematic pogrom in Germany, November 38, the so-called Reichskristallnacht, that's the night of the broken glass, Einstein had sought to explain the essential character of Jews. The bond that has united the Jews for 1,000 years and that unites them today is above all the democratic ideal of social justice, coupled with the ideal of mutual aid and tolerance among all men. Even the most ancient religious scriptures of the Jews are steeped in these social ideals, which have powerfully affected Christianity and Mohammedanism, and have had a benign influence upon the social structure of a great part of mankind. Judaism demanded of Einstein moral engagement with the world, and this was to be the bedrock of his political thinking and pronouncements for the rest of his life. At the same time, his sense of marginality, of what some have called dissimilation, the opposite of Habas, assimilation, shielded him from the world. What emerged was a view of the political landscape that some have termed idealistic, some naive. I prefer to see it as distilled from the disciplined passion of an individual ruthlessly true to himself and to his definition of Judaism. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Robert. We have time for a few questions from the audience. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand and one of our ushers will bring you a microphone. Question down here. Somebody's just going to bring you a microphone.
Could you maybe tell us something about Einstein?
I'm sorry.
Could you tell us, please, something about Einstein's perspective of God?
Well, he was asked that very question by a New York rabbi and was sent a return telegram. It was to be stated in, I think, 25 or 50 words or less, what he thought of God. He can do a better job of that probably than I can. As I recall, though, he, in effect, embraces the God of Spinoza, who was a great influence on him, whose sayings he read also as a young man. And as we know, I mean, Spinoza was himself excommunicated by the Jewish community of Amsterdam for his unorthodoxy It was a belief in God being immanent in his works, which is nature, to which he devoted his life, discovering the laws underlying it. In doing so, which is the mysticism of God's nature, was that which fascinated him all his life, and which he tried to understand. So, in the sense of trying to understand God's nature, he was that was his religion, in effect.
Question over here, please.
I believe that Einstein was offered the presidency of Israel at one time. Would you like to say a few words about these events?
Yeah. I did speak about that yesterday, but of course you weren't here. In 1952, Chaim Weizmann, with whom he had made the trip in 1921 to the United States, died, and Einstein was offered the presidency of the State of Israel. He gave a number of reasons for not acceding. The official ones were that he was too old, that he had an affinity for objective matters, science. He had a long-term recognition of the fact that politics were fraught with emotion and sense and subjectivity. He also said in a telling phrase that he didn't want to be put in a position where he would have to, his conscience would rebel against the positions of the state to which he was president, without making any predictions about how he would react to the state of affairs after 1948, which is another question. It's clear that he didn't feel that was something he was prepared to do. There's of course a nice little twist to this. The David Ben-Gurion, whose picture we just saw, first prime minister, he is the one who had Abba Eban offer Einstein the presidency of the State of Israel, and he's supposed to have told his friend Maya Weisgall, who is this fellow right here, arm in arm with Einstein before the Anglo-American Committee. Weisgall is supposed to have said that Ben-Gurion, when he offered it, said, "What do we do if he accepts?" So I would say it was a calculated bluff. And Ben-Gurion was good at calculated bluffs.
Question over here.
This is a follow-up to the first question. Of course, Einstein didn't believe in a personal God and didn't believe in the religious observations. But is there any evidence that he believed in an intelligent creator? Has he mentioned that anywhere? Or he only talked about God in a metaphorical sense?
Well, I'm not a theologian. Metaphorical is probably the wrong word. I think perhaps that is, he certainly did not believe in a personal God. He described the sense of wonder and the sense of mystery in trying to understand how the universe functioned. That was for him approaching the divine, approaching the mysterious. I mean, he recognized that, which I think is probably true now in discussions of science and religion, that there are certain things, one question is if a priori there are certain things that man will never know, or are there just things that lie beyond our ken now and we will discover them later. In any case, that area which is now what the religious person would call supernatural and what someone more neutrally might describe as extra natural are things that may later be found to be subject to cause and effect. As you know, one of the important, it's even more than a law, it's a fundamental understanding of how the universe works. Einstein refused in large part to accept the quantum theory of which he had been one of the founding members, shall we say, with Planck, because of its randomness. and because of the fact that it was not subject to the laws of cause and effect. So cause and effect for him, if you will, to substitute God for that, perhaps. That's the best answer I can give.
Robert, on that note, I'd like to thank you not only for your lecture this morning, but also for taking the time to spend a couple of days at Perimeter Institute. It's been just wonderful having you. And look forward to your participation in Bistro Banter this afternoon. Bistro Banter with host Howard Burton at 4 o'clock with John Dawson and David Rowe and Robert Schulman. Robert, thank you very much.